You know, the subject of global warming, climate change, it's packed with emotion, regardless of what end of the spectrum you're on here. It's packed with emotion. People get upset. Well, we're going to talk with a former NASA scientist in just a moment, Roy Spencer, back on Coast to Coast AM. His latest work, The Great Global Warming Blunder, How Mother Nature Fooled the World's Top Climate Scientists. Roy is next on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Roy Spencer, principal research scientist at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. He directs research into the development and application of satellite passive microwave remote sensing techniques. Now, they measure global temperature, water vapor, and precipitation. Dr. Spencer, also the recipient of NASA's Medal for Exceptional Scientific Achievement and the American Meteorological Society Special Award for his satellite-based temperature monitoring work. He received his Ph.D. in meteorology from the University of Wisconsin back in 1981. Here he is back on Coast to Coast. Roy, how are you?
Good, George. Good to hear you again.
You too. Boy, what a weekend for weather in the Midwest. Tornadoes, horrible deaths. Angry planet these days, Roy, isn't it?
Well, you know, that's the trouble with weather, is that it seems like abnormal weather is normal. In fact, if you look at the statistics, the number of tornadoes we've had in recent years is at a low. Tornado activity really has not increased in recent years.
Roy, I want to talk about this global warming craze and the talk about climate change as well. In your opinion, why is it so emotional? Because every time I do programs like this, or I talk to people, I try to hold back because it starts off as a conversation, but I got to tell you, almost every time the person who doesn't want to accept what may or may not be going on just goes nuts. How come? Why is it so emotional?
Well, I think global warming sort of taps into our religious and philosophical beliefs, our worldview. Everybody has a view about our relationship to nature. Some people think that nature is fragile and somehow divine, and then other people think that, you know, nature is here for mankind to use. So it's sort of like a religious argument, I think. So I think that's one answer to your question. Another might be that some people like the idea. In fact, I've had people tell me this in the public, that they like the idea that we are somehow in control of nature, because otherwise they feel vulnerable to the whims of nature.
Well, and just yesterday, Saturday, when I witnessed a 60-mile-an-hour wind, which I guess you could say was a mini tornado, I thought that very same thing, Roy. I said, you know what? I wish we could stop this. I wish we could control this, but you can't, no matter, you know, how powerful you might be or how financially able you might be, you're not going to stop Mother Nature from doing what it does.
Yeah, like they used to say, it's not nice to fool Mother Nature.
No, not at all. Let's talk about some general things, and then I want to spend some time for the rest of the night talking about your latest work, The Great Global Warming Blunder. Global warming, climate change, regardless of why it's caused, is the planet, in your opinion, warming up?
You know, I get that question a lot, and I tell people that there's no way to know whether it's warming right now. We only see warming or cooling in the rearview mirror after it's happened.
Explain that.
Well, all we know is what's happened up to this point. We really don't know what's going on right now. You know, we'll have to see what temperatures are next year and the next year and the next year before we can say, oh, okay, well, it looks like back in 2010 we were in a warming trend, or it looks like we are in a cooling trend. That's the trouble with climate, is it's really hard to tell what's going on because the time scales are so long.
Well, how many years do you need? I mean, can't we go back to 1990 and say, okay, we looked at the last 20 years, and this is what happened?
Well, it turns out there really isn't any special time scale that's used, because climate varies on all different time scales. The shortest time scale for climate variability is 1 year to the next. You know, is 1 year different than the next? Is one winter colder than the previous winter? So that's That's a one-year change, but then there's variations in the climate system on all time scales that are longer than that. We talk about decadal and multi-decadal climate change, so that's, you know, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. If we look at proxy temperature data, it looks like there's about a 1,000-year or a 2,000-year cycle. We're unusually warm now, but we were at least as warm back in the medieval warm period, which was 1,000 years ago. So it's occurring on all time scales. Now, what's interesting is that when you talk about normal weather, when the Weather Service says, you know, the temperature was above normal or below normal for this date, they use a 30-year window, a 30-year climate normal period, which isn't that long, but it still recognizes the fact that climate changes even in 50 years.
Well, and it does change dramatically, too. I mean, it's almost like a roller coaster. I mean, I remember winters growing up in Detroit and also St. Louis in the Midwest, where some summers we had a lot of heat, other summers it was cool, some winters we got a lot of snow, other winters we didn't. I remember this winter in January before I went back to Los Angeles, Roy, it was freezing. It was 5 degrees. It was one of the coldest I've experienced in a long time. Next year it could be warm. So it does go through these mini cycles, doesn't it?
Oh, sure. For instance, the eastern U.S. this past winter was especially brutal. Cold air plunged so far south that corals down in the Florida Keys were frozen, were killed by the cold weather. And that hasn't happened since the 1970s, which was also a cold period.
Can you say that we are not necessarily in a warming trend, but is the planet warm right now?
Yes. Yeah. Both of the main measures of global temperatures that are used, the Surface Thermometer Network, which, you know, there's a lot of debate over and a lot of controversy. I think even though there are a lot of uncertainties about the global thermometer data, the data do suggest that we're warmer now than we've been in the modern instrumental record. And the same thing shows up in our satellite data. That's the data that John Christie and I produced here at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. We're very warm right now. And we've had, you know, even though I'm considered a global warming skeptic, someone who's skeptical of man-made global warming, we've been under a little attack from, you know, recently from skeptics who said, how can it be so warm averaged over the Earth when North America was so cold this winter? Well, it just so happens that the most below normal temperatures that occurred this past winter were over North America and Europe, where most people, you know, in the Western world live.
I've had a guest or two on, Roy, and they think we're in the early stages of an ice age, for crying out loud.
You know, George, that's the nice thing about climate change research is you can predict whatever you want for the future, and no one will ever remember 20 or 30 years from now whether you were right or wrong, you know. The poor old weatherman gets blamed the very next day for being wrong. But, you know, I could predict whatever I want for 10 or 30 years from now, and no one would remember.
Roy, every once in a while we'll have a story of an ice sheet breaking off the size of a little state, and they talk about it, and it's floating around, and that the ice caps are melting. Are they disappearing, or are they getting bigger?
Well, in the last 30 years, which is basically the modern satellite record. So it's the only period over which we have really good measurements of Arctic sea ice and sea ice around Antarctica. There has been a big decrease in the coverage of sea ice in the Arctic Ocean. In the Antarctic, it's actually increased, so that the total amount of ice, of sea ice I'm talking about, has remained just about steady for the last 30 years that we've been measuring. But, you know, big difference between northern and southern hemisphere. The Arctic has warmed a lot in the last 30 years, and this is something that I discuss in the book, which we'll talk about in the next hour, which is that this happened back in the 1920s and 1930s. We were just as warm, or at least the Arctic was, back then, but there was no way to measure how much ice covered the Arctic Ocean. You know, there was no reason to go out there. There wasn't any easy way to get out there.
What's happening to the sun? Anything? unusual?
Well, those that like to watch the sun are, you know, do say it's quite remarkable how quiet the sun has been recently in terms of the sunspot activity. And there are those out there who have theories that sunspots indirectly control climate on the Earth through the sunspot's ability to, again, indirectly control cloud cover on the Earth. And clouds are the Earth's natural sunshade. So, yeah, from what I understand, I don't follow the details. The sun is fairly inactive right now. I've been told record low sunspot activities, maybe for hundreds of years, you know, the lowest that's been seen in hundreds of years. I don't think it's important for climate, but, it's entirely possible something is going on there. In climate research, I go for the lower-hanging fruit, the stuff that we can actually measure. The whole sunspot thing is still fairly speculative.
Okay, and back to the glaciers for a moment. If they're melting, could they increase sea levels to that level that some people have feared, to the point where they're going to, wipe out Britain, for example?
Oh, well, I don't think that would happen because there's most of Britain is too high.
All right.
But Florida, you know, a lot of Florida sits pretty low, you know,
yeah.
Like only 10 or 15 feet above
sea level.
Jim Hansen with NASA, who's probably, you know, America's most famous global warming proponent, he's really out there sort of on the opposite of extreme as I am. And he you know, points out that if the Greenland ice sheet, for instance, melted, you know, then we'd have sea level rise of, 15 or 20 feet. It would be substantial. But we know it was just as warm, if not warmer, back in the 1930s, and Greenland did just fine. So, there's enough fresh water tied up in the Greenland ice sheet and the Antarctic ice sheet to substantially affect global sea levels. The question is, would they ever melt to that extent? You had mentioned the ice breaking off of Antarctica. Now, that's a different kind of ice. You know, sea ice is one thing. It can melt, and sea level will not rise, just like ice cubes.
It's like an ice cube, yeah.
Yeah, like an ice cube. If an ice cube melts in your glass, it doesn't raise the level of water in the glass. That's because it was floating anyway. Well, you know, the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheet, if that melts, then you've got sea level rise. Now, the Antarctic ice sheet is unusual in that it has ice shelves all around Antarctica. Parts of the Antarctic ice sheet have extended out over the ocean. They call them ice shelves because they're sitting out over the ocean. And eventually they have to break off, which has happened quite a bit in recent years. And the reason why that happens is, as long as snow continues to fall on Antarctica, it continues to slowly flow towards the sea. That's
right.
The way ice sheets work. It doesn't mean you're losing the ice sheet because you're dumping snow on the interior at the same time that you're breaking off ice shelves around the periphery. Well, of course, a lot of global warming advocates claim that this is a sign of global warming, that we've had more ice shelves break off of Antarctica. Well, we don't know how many used to break off in the 1800s and 1700s and 1600s. Besides, there really hasn't been any warming in Antarctica. How could it be warming on the periphery of Antarctica and have the ice shell break off as a result? And yet sea ice around Antarctica has been increasing. You know, it doesn't make sense.
No, and what are some of the sizes of these sea ice sections? Are they huge?
Well, these pieces of the ice sheet that break off, or I guess, or, you know, some are, or at least one, I guess, was about the size of New Hampshire or something. It, you know, it was huge. But then, you know, everything is relative.
All of
the United States is only a little over 2% of the surface area of the Earth.
I had heard that a Saudi prince wanted to tow an iceberg to Saudi Arabia somehow and melt it down for water.
Right. That was discussed probably 20, 30, 40 years ago. It was seriously discussed, a way to bring fresh water to cities that have trouble getting fresh water. You know, let's say L.A. goes through a prolonged drought and
sure,
they can't get water. Yeah, there were ideas to go down there and grab onto a big iceberg, something that's broken off of Antarctica, and drag it northward. Well, it takes a long time to drag one of those things, and you end up losing most of the iceberg before you get it where you want to go, and it melts, so you don't have much left. So I think that's the main reason the idea was finally abandoned.
Is there any region on this planet, Roy, that if all the ice melt, underneath what you would find would be trees and frozen animals and things like that? Is there anything like that anywhere?
Oh, sure. That's already happened. In northern Siberia, where snow has melted back, they find the these woolly mammoths encased, which is still a big mystery what caused that. And maybe you've even done a show on it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Because that was an instantaneous freeze, wasn't it?
Well, whatever it was, it happened quick, yes.
Yeah.
You're right. And I've often thought about that and tried to think, based on what we know about climate, how I could envision something like that happening. And I still can't envision it. And let's see, where else? Oh, yes. Some people are surprised to learn that in Europe and in Western Canada, some of these glaciers have been melting back probably at least since the 1800s and revealing tree stumps. Well, if a glacier melts back and reveals tree stumps, that means sometime in the past there wasn't a glacier there anyway.
That's right.
So global warming advocates point to, that as evidence of man-made global warming. Okay. If mankind is causing this meltback of the ice of these glaciers, what caused it to be melted back before so much that you would have trees growing there?
Exactly.
Obviously, nature causes climate change, and that is something, believe it or not, that modern climate researchers simply do not believe anymore.
What are the possibilities that would create that somewhat instantaneous freeze, for example, that killed that mammoth? What could cause something to freeze that fast? What are the possibilities?
Boy, I don't know. A dramatic change in global circulation patterns is all I can think of. Maybe related to an abrupt change in the ocean circulation.
Would an asteroid, for example, a huge one, have to plunge into the planet? Could that do that?
Well, it's kind of like, when Krakatoa blew up in the 1800s, which was the largest volcanic eruption, in hundreds of years. It caused what they called years without a summer in Europe.
Yeah.
But that takes time to happen. The cooling of the Earth. If you were to shut off the sun, for instance, tomorrow, it would take weeks for the Earth to cool down. It just takes time to lose that excess heat to outer space. So I don't see how you freeze these woolly mammoths that have, flowers still in their mouths where they've been grazing. I just don't understand it.
No. What about
with
a pole
an
shift?
Asteroid, I don't understand it.
Would a pole shift do that? If everything flipped?
Well, no matter what you envision, you still have to cool things down very rapidly.
Interesting.
And I just don't know how you do that. Now,
all right, we're going to take this quick break. Let's come back to that and more in just a moment. We're talking with Dr. Roy Spencer, the great global warming blunder. Fascinating. I'll be back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're with Dr. Roy Spencer. Roy, you were finishing up on your thoughts on Instafreeze, I guess. Let's pick that back up from there if you want.
Instafreeze?
Yeah, that's my verbiage for instant freezing.
Yeah, I frankly don't see how it happens, but apparently it looks like it did happen in the past. Climate change is something that we generally think of that it takes a long time to happen, but those woolly mammoths frozen in the Siberian North make it look like it's indeed possible for something like that to happen fairly quickly. Now there are things that are physically impossible. For instance, a lot of people have seen that movie, The Day After Tomorrow.
As a matter of fact, Whitley Strieber's book,
yes,
and our film was based on that.
Right, right. And, by coincidence, huh? Anyway, there's based loosely on the theory that there can be a small change in the circulation of the North Atlantic that can cause a mini ice age. Well, with a little bit of dramatic license, you can make that happen day after tomorrow. But part of that, the movie, which I thought was very good special effects, which was totally impossible physically, was to have cold air from the stratosphere come down and freeze everything. Well, yeah, this is sort of a basic mechanism of weather, that if you bring air down from any altitude, it will be warmer than the surrounding air, not colder. That's just the way it works. It heats by compression. Okay. So, you know, even though when you're flying up in a jet and it's 40 below zero outside, if you were to actually take that air in a balloon and bring it down to the surface, the air inside the balloon would actually be warmer than the environment.
Last week, we were witnessing volcanic eruptions from Iceland, a very volcanic area on this planet. Does that have any connection with what's going on today with, climate warming or anything like that?
I would say no. We were joking about the volcano when it first erupted, my friends and I, associates, that it was only a matter of time before someone blamed the volcanic eruption on man-made global warming, which happened within like 24 hours.
Right.
You know, there was a news report where someone was speculating on that, which is just, you know, ridiculous. The kinds of energy we're talking about, even with the extra CO2 we're putting in the atmosphere, the ocean, the Earth's crust, you know, really, there's really no way for it to know this has happened. You know, the forces involved are just way too small compared to what's happening inside the Earth.
Roy, is it easier these days or more difficult for meteorologists to predict the weather?
It's easier. And the increase in forecast skill that has occurred over the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years is mainly through these computerized weather forecast models. They have gotten better over the years. Now, there is an ultimate limit of maybe 10 days or 14 days beyond which you really can't measure weather, which is due to chaos or the butterfly effect, which I believe is actually something that occurs in the climate system on much longer time scales. But, you know, maybe that's something we can talk about in the next hour when we talk about the book. But weather forecast skill has improved. Now, it has improved slowly, but it has definitely improved. And it's through our ability to put the forces of the atmosphere, the dynamics, the thermodynamics, in the form of equations and put those equations into computers. And you start up the computer and tell it what's happening right now and say, tell me what's going to happen in the future. And the weather forecasts have gotten pretty good. Of course, you know, that doesn't mean that on a day when you've got a chance of thunderstorms, you know when a thunderstorm is going to happen 6 hours in advance. You know, we may never know how to do that. There are just some things that are inherently unpredictable.
Well, in weather nowadays, even for local television news, has gotten so serious early in the days of television news. You know, they always had an attractive weather woman or a funny guy doing the weather. They were not certified by the American Meteorological Society. They did not have degrees in science like that. They were communicators. And then later on, as television news got very competitive, all of a sudden stations started hiring, you know, college-educated meteorologists and men and women who had the AMA seal. It got serious, and I think it's still serious, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. It's a combination of serious forecasting and entertainment. You know, it's a competitive market, so, you know, you want forecasters that look good on camera or know what they're talking about, can think on their feet if there's a tornado-producing storm happening at the time, know something about weather, and can entertain people. Now, these days, it turns out that a lot of the people that go into broadcast meteorology and appear on TV were, you know, more interested in broadcasting, but they go to a college, I think it's at the University of Mississippi or Mississippi State, I forget which one, where they have a special broadcast meteorology program.
Uh-huh. And I guess they get their AMA seal that way, which
right,
is
right. They get their bachelor's of science degree in meteorology or broadcast meteorology, and then they can call themselves a meteorologist.
Do these television weather forecasters come up with all their own forecasts, or do they simply get what comes from the National Weather Service?
For the most part, they get what comes from the National Weather Service. There's what is called weather guidance. Like I said, today, the fundamental basis for all weather forecasts are these computerized weather forecast models that are run at least every 12 hours at different weather forecasting centers around the world. The main one in the United States is in Washington, D.C. And the National Weather Service then puts out all of the output from these weather forecast models in different forms, and then the weatherman, the meteorologist, wherever he works, TV, radio, whatever, looks at the output. There's actually computerized forecasts he could rely on completely, he or she could rely on completely if they wanted to, if they didn't want to put any thought into it. But usually a forecaster wants to look at everything and decide whether the forecast model is probably off in a certain direction, or you know, so they try to add a little skill. But that's getting harder and harder these days. To add skill to these forecasts. So in the end, it ends up that a lot of the forecasts you hear are almost verbatim what is the result of these computerized forecast models.
A lot of newspapers across the country, Roy, are coming up with 10-day forecasts, which I assume they're getting also from the National Weather Service. Can they really predict out that far, 10 days, even with the computer models?
If there is a significant change in weather patterns coming, then sometimes yes. In the weather forecast model, there's an extended range forecast model that they put out forecast from, which goes out 10 days in advance, like you said. And I look at that every day. I look at that every day. And in the wintertime, sometimes it does indeed see that there is a big cold air outbreak coming down across Siberia and across the pole to northern Canada and down into the United States, and the model can see this thing coming as much as 10 days in advance.
If there is a storm brewing, let's say, 6 days away from St. Louis, let me rephrase that, 250 miles away, and the storm is rolling along at about 40 miles an hour, can you accurately predict that it'll be here in about 6 days, or does it dissipate by the time it gets to you?
Storm systems, if it's a thunderstorm system, those have lifetimes on the order of hours to a day or so.
Okay.
So if you see those coming, yeah, sometimes you can pretty accurately forecast when it's going to come on through. And, in fact, I've done that on numerous occasions. When I've been asked to forecast for, you know, some outdoor musical concert event or something. But then, you know, those are sort of special situations. If it's going to be just pop-up thunderstorm activity that you don't know where it's going to occur, or even if it's going to occur in a stagnant air mass over the southeast U.S. in the middle of summer, that's much more difficult to forecast.
Tell us some of your work with NASA at the time, Roy. What did you do?
When I was with NASA, I worked on different kinds of satellite instrumentation, both existing instrumentation to try to figure out how weather and climate works, and to, for instance, monitoring hurricanes, new methods for monitoring the intensity of hurricanes. Early on, I was working on an instrument that we were going to fly on a space shuttle, but then the Challenger accident happened, and everything got changed in terms of what was going to fly on the space shuttle. My main claim to fame has been working with John Christie for the last, we've been doing it now for, 20 years? Yeah, for 20 years, we've been doing the global temperature monitoring with satellite instruments. These are instruments that were made to measure global weather patterns from space, which then the data went into these weather forecast models, but we started using them for climate. We prove that these instruments could be used for climate monitoring. You know, you could measure very small temperature changes from year to year averaged over the planet of only hundredths of a degree. And then lately, more recently, I've been digging into the details of how the climate system works. Also, I'm a lead scientist on an instrument that flies on the Aqua spacecraft, which is a NASA spacecraft. It's been flying since 2002. I'm the lead scientist in the United States on the instrument that measures a lot of different things, including sea ice in the Arctic and the Antarctic.
Can you, via satellite, predict certain areas around this planet? And are there planets, are there areas on this planet that are trouble spots weather-wise than other areas?
You mean in terms of forecasting?
Forecasting, yeah.
Sure. Any place where there's a lot of changes happening, where you've got warm air masses colliding with cold air masses. For instance, well, it'd be just to the east of any of the major continents, you know, east of North America, east of Asia, you know, that's where you've got cool air masses that build up over land coming across the ocean, or you've got warm oceanic air masses coming up into land. Any place where these air masses collide is more difficult for forecasting weather. It's where the action is. It's where there are huge changes in forces in the atmosphere. So any of those places are more difficult to forecast for. Now, you know, on the other flip side of that is that there are certain regions where weather is fairly constant. You know, let's say Southern California, during certain times of the year, it's going to be mostly sunny to sunny every day after day after day. You know, they're in a persistent high-pressure area where the air is slowly sinking, and seldom are there, you know, big air mass temperature differences. Of course, Southern California in the wintertime can have some dramatic changes, but other times of the year, the changes are nothing like we see in the eastern U.S., where forecasting then is much more difficult.
The folks who predict hurricanes, and you've had some experience with that, how can they predict them way in advance each year? And sometimes they're not right.
Yeah, I would say that probably most of the time they're not right. it's a really difficult problem. I got a sister that lives down in the Florida Keys, and she gets hopping mad that the National Hurricane Center even puts out hurricane projections for the coming hurricane season.
Yeah, well, why do they do that, by the way?
Because they can.
Because they can. Okay.
Well, they've looked at past years, and they've noticed that, on average, over many years, we find that there are more hurricanes in the Atlantic Basin during La Nina years than there are during El Nino years. So, you know, if we see an El Nino or La Nina coming, then, you know, they will forecast either more hurricanes than normal or fewer hurricanes than normal. Trouble is that that's just, you know, one of many factors involved in hurricane. For instance, 2005, I mean, that was like the perfect storm of conditions for hurricane activity. You know, every disturbance that formed out over the ocean seemed to turn into a hurricane, and then it seemed like most of those ended up hitting the U.S. You know, that's when people were going nuts, saying, look what man-made global warming is causing. And then, of course, you know, years after that, where did all the hurricanes go? For instance, this past hurricane season, pretty quiet.
Very, yeah.
Even though sea surface temperatures were running pretty high, it just shows you that, you know, warm sea surface temperatures do not a hurricane make. It takes a lot of different factors, wind shear and how many disturbances are coming off of West Africa, which then can generate into hurricanes. There's just a lot of factors that make long-range forecasting of hurricanes really difficult.
And what do we know about this summer? Is it going to be ultra-hot here in this country?
Oh, that's something that I don't even predict, because I don't think we can predict. Except to the extent that there is a 30-year cycle called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. And it appears that two or three years ago, we might have gone back into a cooling trend portion of that cycle, which has been bringing us weather patterns for the last two or three summers and winters, at least in the eastern U.S., that were more reminiscent of the 1970s, let's say, when it was colder. You know, for instance, this past winter in the eastern U.S., the corals that froze down in Key West, this is stuff that happened back in the 1970s. And there are some people that think, and you know, if I had to choose, I would say this is the most likely thing that is happening, is that we're back into a cooling period that's going to bring us both winters and summers that are more like we saw back in the 60s and 70s. But, you know, that forecast is worth just what you paid for it, George.
Because the following year it could all change again, right?
That's right.
Now, the great global warming blunder, how Mother Nature fooled the world's top climate scientists. We're going to get into this. We're going to get into some of those emails that were floating around. We're going to get into the entire situation. And then in our final hour with Dr. Roy Spencer, we'll take your phone calls as well. When you started off as a meteorologist, Roy, as a scientist, what was your position?
You mean on global warming?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I started out, nobody was really talking about global warming. It was just, you know, starting to poke its head up as a potential issue for the future. So most people that went in that are my age in their 50s that went into weather were expecting to go into some form of weather forecasting, whether it's developing new methods or new methods of monitoring weather from satellites, which is what I was in, or working for the National Weather Service. It was all weather-related. Well, of course, now everything is climate, and everyone's becoming a climate expert, even though, you know, no one, very few of us were ever learned very much about climate when we went to school in meteorology. Even people like Al Gore are now climate experts, right?
Yeah.
So
award-winning climate experts.
Award-winning, yes. Yeah, I thought it was very cool that he got that Academy Award for Best Science Fiction Movie.
But was there a gut feeling, was there an instinct about this that kept pushing you in the direction you are in now?
I think so. I think I mentioned early this in the show to you that people have different worldviews about how nature works.
Sure.
And in my worldview, nature is very resilient, very resistant to change. If we push hard enough, we can change nature in a measurable amount, but not by a large amount. So, yeah, I was predisposed to not believe in man-made global warming.
All right, stay with us. More to come. And, well, hold back, because here we go. The great global warming blunder next on Coast to Coast AM. Sometimes I think, too, Roy, with a lot of people who are believing in the man-made global warming theory, that they think people who believe that this planet is going through a cycle don't care about pollution or the environment, and that's not the case. I want to ask you, of course, do you get that much when people question you? You know, do you care about pollution? Do you care about the environment?
Sometimes people give you a hard time that, you know, accusing me that I really don't care, especially, you know, the accusation that somehow I'm in the pocket of big oil, and therefore they're the ones that control what I say about the climate system and all of that, when in fact they've never asked me to do anything, let alone offered to pay me to do it. I love nature as much as other people do. I got lots of nature in my backyard where I live. But I, you know, I don't worship it either, and that's the difference. Is that, you know, everyone wants a clean environment, but how far different people are willing to go to achieve that can vary widely.
Well, absolutely. Now, you talk about the great global warming blunder. What's the blunder?
The blunder is that all of the climate experts have made a fundamental mistake in trying to figure out how the climate system works, and specifically whether nature is going to cause a lot of warming as a result of us putting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And the blunder has to do with clouds, the operation of clouds in the climate system. All of the climate models that they run on computers and virtually all of the climate scientists now believe that clouds will change in such a way with warming, warming from the extra CO2 that's in the atmosphere, clouds will change in such a way to greatly amplify that warming. And what I discovered was that they had made a fundamental blunder in their interpretations of how clouds work in the climate system. And what I, the evidence that I found and that I actually show in peer-reviewed scientific papers now is that clouds operate in just the opposite manner. And the reason why this is important for global warming is whether clouds amplify global warming or reduce it makes all the difference in the world. It makes the difference between whether man-made global warming ends up being barely distinguishable within the realm of natural climate variability or whether we're headed for a global warming Armageddon like Al Gore thinks we are.
Well, that's a good point. And, you know, and also, you know, the subtitle of the work is How Mother Nature Fooled the World's Top Climate Scientists. Did they really get fooled, Roy, or did they want to get fooled?
Oh, I think to some extent they want to get fooled. This is a business. You know, I keep getting questions from the public. Because how can, you know, this is science. Don't you scientists figure out how things work just based on the data? And what I try to get across to people is that making measurements, even if you had perfect measurements of the climate system or of anything else in nature, that's the easy part. The hard part is understanding what those measurements are telling you about nature in terms of cause and effect. And that's what I emphasize in the book, is mixing up of cause and effect seems to be at the root of a lot of misunderstanding about the way nature works. I've even seen this in medical research. You know, you'll see, oh, in the newspaper, news articles where they've found some connection between some behavior and some medical problem, and you look at it and you think, wait a minute, how do they know that that caused that and it wasn't the other way around? Well, this is what I found in my research, is that scientists have mixed up cause and effect when measuring cloud and temperature variability. And the reason why I wrote a book about it is because this cause versus effect thing is so easy to understand that I have found that the public, when I give lectures around the country, the public understands what I'm talking about better than the climate experts do. Believe it or not, they have no idea what I'm talking about, and it's because they don't think in terms of cause and effect.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, about cause and effect, and the clouds in general. And why don't they understand this, by the way? I mean, they're scientists, for crying out loud.
I don't know. It's, you know, some people think in terms of equations. Too many of these people think in terms of equations. I think more in terms of concepts and then use equations as a tool to, you know, look into the details of those concepts, see whether the concepts that you have in your brain, whether you can actually demonstrate them with real physical laws. It ends up that you, in order to do a good job in this business, you got to master both. You can't just be a mathematician. You can't just have concepts. Either way, you can get misled. If I can tell you what the actual blunder was, how I got into this 3 years ago.
Okay.
Global warming, the fear of global warming, isn't based upon the direct warming from more CO2 in the atmosphere. Okay, a lot of people don't understand that. It's not the direct warming from the extra CO2 in the atmosphere. That, everyone agrees, is quite small. The fear is that nature will change in ways to greatly amplify that warming, like I mentioned earlier, a change in cloudiness that will amplify this little bit of warming influence from the extra CO2. Well, a few years ago, before I started getting into this issue of you know, how clouds change, whether they will amplify global warming or reduce global warming, I would ask, you know, scientists, how do we know that global warming is going to be that bad? And they said, well, when we look at 1 year versus another year, and you know, you've got a warm year versus a cold year, globally averaged, I'm talking about, not
okay.
City, but over the whole Earth, some years are warmer than others. And they said, when we have an unusually warm year, globally averaged, we typically have less cloud cover of the Earth. And they said, so that proves that when it's warming, when you're warming, the clouds tend to dissipate, which lets in more sunlight, which amplifies the warming. And as a meteorologist, the first thing I thought of was, wait a minute, how do you know the warming caused less cloud cover and it wasn't the less cloud cover that caused the warming? And it turns out that they didn't know, and in fact, they had never asked that question before, which just astounded me. And then I had to learn how to talk in their terms, climate with simple climate models and equations. So it took me a couple of years to come up to speed with their language, which was equations and climate models, and then demonstrate through our publications that, see, here's what happens if you mix up cause and effect. And it sounds like a trivial thing, but it's amazingly difficult to prove to people or to scientists. But yeah, that's how it all got started, was I just conceptually thought, wait a minute, they could be mixing up cause and effect when they look at cloud and temperature variation. And as we look in detail at the satellite data, okay, which is what I mostly do, is try to figure out how nature works from different kinds of satellite data, we figured out a way to tell the difference between clouds causing temperature to change or temperature causing clouds to change. And that's when we discovered, oh my gosh, Mother Nature has fooled these top climate scientists.
How could so many scientists be wrong on this issue? I mean, one would say, and we're going to take phone calls next hour, and I'm sure you're going to get some of these calls, where if you got 1,000 scientists and, you know, 900 of them think that we're creating man-made global warming, how could they be wrong? Now, I don't know what the percent is. Has that changed much?
Probably not. Definitely, I am in the minority. But what people don't realize is that, let's say you had 1,000 scientists and 900, you know, agreed with each other that global warming is man-made and is going to be serious. The truth is, the vast majority of those scientists have never done research that would lead them to that conclusion. All they're doing is voicing what they hear or repeating what they hear over and over. It's a herd mentality. These are not independent opinions, you know, 900 independent scientists that have all looked at the details and have all concluded independently that global warming is man-made. There are just a handful of scientists who have ever looked into the possibility that global warming might be mostly due to Mother Nature. Believe it or not, there has been virtually no research. Out of the billions of dollars we pour into climate change research, there has been virtually no money spent on investigating the possibility that global warming has been part of a natural climate cycle. That research is not done. It is just simply assumed that global warming is man-made. So, and you get this herd mentality going where all the scientists just repeat what the other ones were saying, and everyone figures that there's some super climate expert somewhere that can prove it. But it's not true. And I'm finding that the experts, you know, as I go through this whole cloud versus temperature thing and cause versus effect, excuse me, I'm finding that even the experts do not understand some of the basics of what they're talking about. We have a new science paper coming out in the next couple of months, which talks about this. I had to start over from scratch and lead people, lead the scientists from the beginning and say, okay, here was the first basic explanation of how global warming is caused. Now, here's where everyone went wrong. You know, I say, this turns out this has nothing to do with reality. You know, it's an interesting thought experiment, but it has nothing to do with what we actually see in the climate system. So I feel really good that I finally got this paper accepted for publication after several years of a lot of battles with scientists who just held their hands over their ears and said, no, I don't want to listen.
Now, the skeptics would say that those who are skeptical of you and your theories and those who support you, all right, Who's supporting you? Who's pushing this? Who's fueling this? So you got to ask the question, Roy. You get funded by big oil or not?
I wish, George, I wish I was funded by big oil. Because since I'm accused of it all the time anyway, I might as well have the money, right?
But just disclose it. That's all.
No, big oil knows that I'm more valuable to them being funded by the U.S. government. I'm 100% funded by the U.S. government, always have been. The only reason why I'm speaking out on this, and this is the reason why there are a handful of us around the world that are speaking out on this, is the direction we are going in policy related to global warming is going to kill a lot of people. Okay, there is no large scale replacement yet for fossil fuels, for carbon based fuels. You know, you can eat around the edges a little bit with solar and wind, but the demand for energy by humanity is so huge that there are no practical large-scale replacements for carbon-based fuels yet. And if government forces us to start using very expensive alternatives, it's the poor who suffer first. So, you know, there's a handful of us that are doing what scientists should have been doing all along, which is, wait a minute, let's step back and ask the question, was there something here we missed? Did we make some fundamental mistake in our understanding of how the climate system works? That's my motivation, is, you know, just good science, alternative hypotheses, and trying to make, trying to keep governments from making a drastic mistake that's going to kill a lot of people.
Well, that's a good point. But now let's talk. You mentioned that carbon dioxide. I want to get a better handle on this, that it has increased somewhat. Now, that slight increase, which you don't think is tipping the scales at all, was that man-made, that slight CO2 increase?
The CO2 content of the atmosphere is now about 40% above what it was, let's say, 100 years ago, before we had burned very much in terms of fossil fuels.
All right, 40% above 40 years ago.
Yeah, now it's still a very small number. 100 years ago, let's say only 30 molecules of every 100,000 molecules of air in the atmosphere were carbon dioxide, about 30 out of every 100,000. Well, now it's just about 40 molecules of CO2 out of every 100,000 are carbon dioxide. So in a relative sense, yeah, we've added quite a bit to the atmospheric carbon dioxide, but in an absolute sense, CO2 is still an extremely small fraction of the atmosphere. Now, your question was, are we responsible for that? I've looked into that because, you know, I question everything. What's the possibility that the warming actually caused the increase in CO2? So I've looked into this, and I've looked into, you know, all of the different ways that they've tried to answer this question. And I've pretty much come to the conclusion that I agree with the scientific consensus on this, that we are, if not totally responsible, mostly responsible for the CO2 increase in the atmosphere. But so what? And this is one of the chapters in my new book, The Great Global Warming Blunder. I address the question which real scientists should be asking, which is, hey, since CO2 is necessary for life on Earth, maybe we ought to be discussing the possibility that more CO2 in the atmosphere is actually a good thing on the whole.
Well, that could be too. Should we regulate emissions like we're continuing? You know, the EPA, I think, goes overboard. Should we just cancel all this stuff? We obviously haven't cleaned anything up if it's worse now than it was 40 years ago.
Yeah, well, it's really hard to clean up this whole CO2 thing. Of course, I don't think we need to clean it up, in answer to your question. No, I don't think we should regulate it at all. I think we need to step back and start, you know, reexamining the science of global warming, first of all. And second of all, like I mentioned, we need to address the possibility that more CO2 in the atmosphere is, on a whole, going to be good for life on Earth, because it seems like no matter how much we pump into the atmosphere, Mother Nature automatically gobbles up about 50% of it. It's like life on Earth is starved for carbon dioxide. It's sucking. Life on Earth is sucking on the atmosphere as hard as it can, taking as much carbon dioxide as it can out of the atmosphere. And as we add CO2 to the atmosphere, life on Earth is actually breathing freer. Now, this is what I'm saying here is something that needs to be discussed scientifically, but nobody has the guts to say it because, you know, you'll be accused of being anti-nature or something.
Didn't we have more CO2 during the dinosaur era?
Well, yeah, that's what they say, is there's evidence that CO2 concentrations were much higher in the distant past. Yes, and a lot of geologists don't buy into the whole man-made global warming thing because, you know, they were taught in school that there were huge changes in the past, you know, big changes in climate. CO2 was much higher in the atmosphere millions of years ago, so they say, you know, obviously that wasn't due to SUVs being driven a million years ago. So nature goes through changes. Now, I'm not swayed too much by those arguments. You got to understand, George, that not all skeptics think the same way, have the same ideas. We're not in lockstep. We got our own ideas about what's causing warming and stuff like that. I don't really care much about what happened in the geologic past. What we're talking about is how the climate system operates today and what's going to happen on the time scale of human lifetimes, you know, 100 years, 200 years, not a million years.
Well, Roy, I've got to tell you, I mean, I've talked to a lot of people about climate change, climate, and you seem to be one of the most sensible about all of this. Do you convince some of the skeptics, to sway your way?
Well, there are two or three scientists I know of that now know what I'm talking about because they were reviewers on my papers. So they understand what I'm saying. I don't think they have the courage to speak out and say, you know, this could really fundamentally change what we think about how bad global warming is going to be. Because that would be rocking the boat. They're gonna let me stay with rocking the boat.
All right. Well, hold on for 1 second. I'm going to let you stay with rocking the boat when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. One thing's for certain, Roy, I do believe that this planet is in for some incredible climatic change and will swing on both ends of the spectrum at any given time, at any given year, don't you?
Well, you... You might well be right. I don't know what a tremendous change would be, but, you know, I think humanity needs to be ready for any kind of climate change, and I do think that in the future we're going to be surprised that the biggest climate changes we have to deal with are unpredicted and natural, not man-made.
What's the worst that the planet could do? Huge earthquakes, erupting volcanoes, I would guess, right?
The worst what?
What's the worst climatic change that this planet could do?
Well, huge volcanoes? In the short term, it's volcanoes. Yeah, a really strong explosive eruption of a volcano pumping a bunch of sulfur into the stratosphere. That's the kind of thing that can cause some serious cooling, but it only lasts a couple of years before nature cleans out the atmosphere. So even with these major volcanic eruptions, recent Iceland example not being one of them. That's something that can cause change, but it's fairly large, cooling, but only for a couple of years.
What about the United Nations? What are they doing about all this?
Well, of course, it's the United Nations that has sort of spearheaded the international effort to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. I view this as largely a political exercise. I know some of the people involved that started the whole push 20 years ago to reduce CO2 emissions, and they weren't really interested in saving the Earth. They were more interested in political power. So I view the United Nations as being, you know, this is global warming. The threat of man-made global warming is a convenient excuse for the United Nations to do what comes naturally to them, which is gaining more control over international commerce, over the business affairs of the world.
And I would even take a step further, Roy, and say to try to cripple the United States. I mean, we have already gone from an industrial-based country to one of a service country right now. We've seen what has happened to jobs. We're seeing the effects of that now. I think it'll get worse. I think this has also been a contributing plan to get the United States out of manufacturing, out of making things, which affected the economy. It probably goes even deeper than just an economic ploy of the UN. I think they wanted to cripple the United States, and this is one way that they did it.
Yeah, you're probably right. I think there are movers and shakers out there that do want to do that, even you know, politicians inside the U.S. But, you know, I'm not an expert in that, but I do know some of the players in the climate change arena, and I can tell you that this is more guided, the whole global warming thing and policy changes related to it is guided more by politics than it is by the science.
And speaking of politics, what is this administration, what is Congress doing with all this?
Well, you know, the whole carbon dioxide regulation train left the station 20 years ago. It's like politicians have started this push towards regulating CO2, and it won't matter what the science says now. They want to get CO2 regulations in place because I think they see dollar signs in their eyes. You know, they got dollar signs in their eyes because they see all of the opportunities for new government revenue coming in. And, you know, it's like they got no clue that if they destroy capitalism's ability to generate wealth, you know, there won't be anything to tax.
I mean, I'm all for electric cars. I'm all for getting out of dependence on foreign oil. But at the same time, I happen to believe in the abiotic oil theory. I think this planet makes an abundance of oil, and it's always going to be here, probably for hundreds of thousands of years. That doesn't mean we can't preserve the environment and look for better alternatives, cheaper uses of fuel. I think we should be doing all that and doing it aggressively. But I just have never believed in man-made global warming. And I don't know why, Roy. I'm not a scientist. It's just been instinct and gut, and that's what I've done all these years.
And believe it or not, George, scientists that work in this field, the experts, those that are part of the scientific consensus, also operate based on gut instinct, on their worldviews, their own philosophies, their own religious beliefs. I find this when I talk to them over a beer at night when you're at a scientific conference. That, you know, you push them about all of the uncertainties related to global warming, and eventually they'll come down to saying, yeah, but, you know, getting away from carbon-based fuels is something we need to do anyway. Now, where did that come from out of a scientist?
Yeah.
You know, what the hell do they know about, you know, what we have available to us in terms of energy sources, what those energy sources cost? You know, scientists are the last ones you should listen to about economics because they really have no clue. Well, face it, you know, most of us scientists, you know, while the rest of the country, you know, people, their job is to make money, it's the scientist's job to spend money.
So true. So true. It is still a political football, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. 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 The whole global warming thing is hugely political. It was nearly 20 years ago. I was at the White House talking to Al Gore's main science advisor in environmental areas, and he told me, you know, the ozone problem was something that they fixed by passing new international treaties, laws to reduce the production of ozone depleting chemicals like Freon. And he said, hey, carbon dioxide is next. That's what we're after. We are going to restrict the use of carbon-based fuels. And this was back, you know, when climate modeling was just starting. It wasn't obvious that global warming was due to mankind. Of course, I don't think even today that's obvious, but back then it was even less obvious. But it was clear that this was a political agenda and this is the direction they were going, no matter what the science said, but that the UN, along with you know, the cooperating scientists of the world who all get money from the governments, from their respective governments, got together and, you know, it's a political process, building the scientific case for man-made global warming. That's what the United Nations has done. They have not brought the scientists together to look into the possibility that climate change might be mostly natural. They were never tasked with that. They were tasked to investigate man-made climate change, not find alternative hypotheses. It's been fundamentally politically driven from the start.
Based on the current trend, whether it's political or climate, how do you see this planet in the next 10 years?
You're talking about what happens to the climate system or what happens to humanity trying
both.
To react to the climate system?
I would say both.
Okay, well, as long as people have freedom, which I hope we still have in this country, I think politicians will end up having to do what the public demands. And we've already seen in the last year a change in public opinion on the subject of global warming. We now have surveys that suggest that most Americans now believe that climate change is mostly natural. You can probably, you know, yours truly is probably partly responsible for that change in public opinion.
Yeah.
But I find traveling around that the public is basically disbelieves the idea that mankind can control the weather, can control the climate system. So I think that looking in the future, if global temperatures don't start rising again, I think the public is not going to want to see any kind of legislation to reduce CO2 emissions. Now, that's the United States. Of course, we've got the other major carbon-producing nations of the world are India and China. They are now going through their industrial revolutions, lifting themselves up out of poverty, mm-hmm. and they're basically telling the United States, you know, do what you want, but, you know, U.S. got theirs, and now it's time for China and India to get theirs. And you know, I can't argue with that. They're trying to lift their people up out of poverty. We don't know what it's like to live without electricity, except when the electricity goes off, right? And we have to
right.
deal with without it for 2 hours. Well, there's still a billion people in the world who don't have electricity. You know, imagine living like that. I cannot, in good conscience, advocate any policy that is going to tell them, sorry, we're not going to let you get electricity now because we think we might be causing global warming.
Well, absolutely. You know, you think about just running water and what life was like back a few hundred years ago for people and all the conveniences we have now. And, you know, we want things.
Yeah, if you want to help humanity, you know, don't waste your time fooling around with carbon legislation and trying to prevent global warming. Get people electricity and clean water. That's the best thing that could be done for humanity in the next 10 years.
Absolutely. And they should be doing a more aggressive job chasing companies that dump chemicals and things like that. I'm all for that, aren't you?
Well, of course. You know, you and I are old enough to remember back when, you know, trash was everywhere, lining the roads. Rivers were catching on fire from chemicals we were dumping into the rivers. Lake Erie was dead around 1970. And this is when the public, the United States public, legitimately, you know, had good reason to get involved in environmentalism. But, you know, this is what happens in countries that become industrialized. Through our industrialization, we generate the excess wealth that we need to then turn around and clean up our messes. And that's what we've done, and eventually that's what China will do.
Tell me about the book, The Great Global Warming Blunder. Where do you get it?
Well, it's available just about everywhere, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, you know, all the major retailers, also online, you know. You can get it at all major bookstores. But of course, I haven't personally gone out and checked them all. So I'm just telling you what I hear.
Do you think the mood of scientists will eventually flip? As you said, you're in the minority. Is that going to change?
Boy, I don't know. I think that there is a change in scientific opinion to where there are more scientists who are now thinking that maybe we did make a mistake, or maybe we have overstated the case for man-made global warming. There's one scientist, I won't mention her name, who's fairly central in the global warming debate, who actually has switched to our side recently, partly because of the behavior she's seen from the ClimateGate people. You and I haven't really talked about ClimateGate tonight, you know, the release of emails from...
That's coming.
Yeah, okay. But anyway, after she saw the way some scientists are behaving on the United Nations side of this issue, she decided, you know, maybe we have been misled to some extent.
Well, that could be too. That could be too indeed. Well, if a poll were taken today, we know what the American public would generally start saying. That's tipping. We've just talked about that. Scientists, I think that would tip too. ClimateGate, we talk about these emails. Was it all about money? Was it all about their research projects?
It's the motivation for research, for working on this global warming issue. For most scientists, there's all kinds of motivations involved here. You mentioned money. That's one of them. I mean, people have got to realize that if the threat of man-made global warming goes away, we don't get funding anymore from Congress. It'll end. And so, therefore, there is a built-in motivation to keep the fear of man-made global warming going. Now, I'm not saying that scientists necessarily conspire to take advantage of the situation. I don't know what's in their hearts. It could be some of them do, that they have their own... you know, they really don't believe in this stuff, but they'll play the game as long as they keep getting research funds. But then also there's less tangible motives on the part of scientists. What scientist wouldn't want to be working on this research project, international research project, to help save the Earth? I mean, that's a very cool thing to be able to work on, right?
Yeah.
So that there's, you know... It's not as fun to think that maybe Mother Nature really doesn't need to be saved from us.
Well, they hurt their own cause.
Philosophical reasons, too.
They hurt their own cause. But we see it, Roy, with everything. We see it with the way the FDA reacts to Big Pharma. And, you know, many of the attorneys, for example, who work for the FDA used to work for some of the companies involved. I mean, it's an endless stream of greed, of corruption, of, you know, let's line my pockets first and use issues to get there. And
yeah.
I just see the same thing happening with ClimateGate and climate warming and global and, you know, and Earth changes. I think they have taken an issue and they're trying to figure out how they can profit from it.
Yeah, and in the end, the scientists that have allowed themselves to be used in this way are hurting science in general. I mean, I predict that scientists, science in general is going to get a black eye over this whole thing, and climate research specifically. You know, no one's going to trust the climate researchers again if this whole global warming house of cards collapses.
I mean, I just don't know why it's human nature not to simply admit when you're wrong to say, I'm wrong.
Well, that's one of the hardest things for a scientist, George, is being wrong. You know, that's the last thing you want to be. Unfortunately, in this business, in trying to demonstrate whether global warming is natural or man-made, it's very difficult to prove or disprove anything. It's like, you know, the more you dig into it, the more you realize that, you know, you could spin this thing either way with the facts, and there's really no way to prove or disprove anything. And it's partly because it is so difficult to sort out cause from effect when we look at the climate system and try to figure out how it works. We had talked about this earlier, and it's the subject of my new book. Is, you know, that's really what it comes down to, is trying to figure out what causes what in the climate system. So what I'm saying is, in a way, the global warming researchers, the United Nations, really doesn't have to worry about being proved wrong. In fact, one of the leading conclusions of the most recent United Nations report on global warming is that they are 90% sure that most of the warming in the last 50 years is man-made. Okay? I'm paraphrasing the main conclusion of that report. Well, I'm thinking to myself, okay, they're 90% sure. Well, if someone does prove that global warming is mostly natural, if it came to that, the United Nations could say, well, that's not inconsistent with what we said. We didn't say we were absolutely sure. We said we were 90% sure.
Yeah, we left open the 10% possibility that we could be wrong.
That's right. So, you know, in the end, they can say, oh, well, that's consistent with what we said, too.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what kind of phone calls we get next hour with you, Roy. You know, let's keep the dialogue moving and moving ahead. When you go out and speak, are people more, do you sense people are accepting your views, or are they throwing tomatoes at you?
Oh, very accepting. In fact, I've never been protested against, which other scientists tell me they have. I kind of feel neglected that hasn't happened yet. Even at liberal universities, University of Wisconsin in Madison, for instance, you know, I spoke there, got no flack whatsoever. When I talk to, regular Americans, the public is very much in agreement with me in general, is what I find, is that they have an instinct, a gut instinct, that climate change is natural and not man-made.
Okay, well, up next, we'll take your phone calls with Dr. Roy Spencer, author of The Great Global Warming Blunder. You're next with us on Coast to Coast AM. Are your views affecting anything for you, Roy, at the University of Alabama, or they let you just say what you want to say?
We have quite a bit of freedom still. Occasionally, we've got the message, it'd be kind of nice if we did more work on both sides of the issue. In other words, you know, maybe hire a climate scientist who's outspoken on the other side. But no, generally speaking, we have freedom to speak out, which is nice, because I know of global warming skeptics, researchers, who have been under a lot of pressure from their universities and even lost their jobs, although there's usually some other excuse for losing their jobs. But everyone knows it's because the university didn't want to be embarrassed by their skeptical views.
You know, that's the same for a number of professors who have spoken out about the exact cause of 9/11. They have their own views about it, but because they're at the university levels, they've lost their jobs. Same reason.
Yeah, it happens.
Let's go to the phones now. We'll go, first of all, to our first-time caller, Ken Moore, Washington. Greg, you're on the air with Dr. Roy Spencer on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Greg.
Hello, Norai, and hello, guests. I'm sorry, I don't recall your name because I was memorizing it.
That's okay, Greg.
All right. Yeah, no, I'm concerned about how global warming is kind of like a science fiction game, a big political science fiction game. And not that I'm really worried about it as much as it may be a necessity in society that we play this global warming game so we can save the resources and all the values of national parks and everything we have for what is worth something for the young. If we destroy and we take down everything that the young have available to them, maybe global warming is just kind of like one of those vague points that we put out there for everybody to understand. The children deserve just what we have, too. I went to a lot of national parks. I enjoyed them very much. I went to a lot very natural, what nature had to offer us. And if we don't have some kind of vague point out there telling us something, well, my question is, do you think that may be very much a true point that we have to use some kind of science fiction political game to save the resources for our young?
Well, I've never heard that kind of question before. I think everyone values nature. Everyone, I think, likes the idea of having parts of the country that are set aside for public to use in a very, you know, sort of non-invasive way. The public is supportive of that. I think what the public is not supportive of is making these places entirely off limits to human use of any kind, which is sort of the direction we're going. You know, and I guess now they're talking about making it illegal to even fish on federal lands is an idea that's being floated right now.
Yeah.
So I don't think they need to make up stories to try to preserve things. I think everyone recognizes that we don't want to live in a, you know, in a cesspool.
You know, when we have ice ages and then we had warm ages, and I'm talking thousands and thousands of years ago, Roy, we didn't have factories, we didn't have cars, yet, you know, we had moments where the climate was worse than it is today. How do the scientists who believe in man-made global warming answer that?
Ah, good question. NASA's James Hansen, who is on the other end of the spectrum on this issue from me, he points to the ice ages as his primary evidence that man-made global warming is going to be serious. Now, this sounds kind of strange to most people. It probably sounds strange to you. How can you point to things like the ice ages and then the warm interglacials, which were clearly natural, as evidence that we're in big trouble from man-made global warming? Well, this is the way he reasons it. He says, well, if we go back then and look at how much CO2 was in the atmosphere during the warm versus the cold areas, or warm versus cold times, the warm interglacials versus the cold ice ages, we find that the CO2 content of the atmosphere now is way above what it was even during the warm interglacials. He says, see, therefore, this extra CO2 is going to cause the warming. And this is where I return to this issue of cause versus effect. I think Jim Hansen is mixing up cause versus effect. Back during those periods of time over the last several hundred thousand years when we had ice ages and warm interglacials, I think it was the changing temperatures that caused the CO2 of the CO2 content of the atmosphere to change, and that we really don't know what caused the changing temperatures. Jim Hansen thinks he believes the traditional explanation, which is the Milankovitch cycle. That's the very small and slow changes in the orbit geometry between the Earth and the Sun. That, you know, during ice ages, supposedly there was a little less sunlight reaching the Earth, and he says, see, all you have is a little tiny change in the sunlight, and you can get a huge change in temperature. Well, it turns out that those Milankovitch cycles do not explain the major ice events, ice age events of the past. So I think we really don't know what caused the ice ages and the interglacials.
If you are wrong, and I'm not saying you're going to be, but I'm just saying if you are wrong, what is it that would get you to change your mind?
Evidence. I mean, I'll go wherever the evidence leads me. One thing you learn as a scientist eventually is that the best thing to do is just not be invested in any specific answer. Be invested in finding the truth. That's what you need to be invested in. So, you know, I'm really not invested either way. I don't really care what the answer is as a scientist. I just want to be correct because that's the last thing a scientist wants to be, is wrong. So what would it take for me to change? I would have to see clear evidence that these cloud effects that I'm talking about, which are, you know, I haven't used the term yet, feedback. They're called feedbacks. How do clouds change with warming? How do other things change with warming? I would have to be shown clear evidence that those things really are positive feedbacks. Those things really are things that happen in the climate system, which are going to amplify that little bit of warming that we get from the CO2 that we all agree, the vast majority of us agree, is going to be caused by the extra CO2 we're putting in the atmosphere. But, George, the purpose of the book is to show the new evidence. I mean, I feel like I am on the cutting edge of this. I feel like I have the new evidence that that they are the ones that are wrong. I understand their arguments, and I've gone beyond them. I've looked at the data more deeply and said, ah, look, you need to look a little closer at the data, and they're the ones that are not looking. So they are the ones that now have to catch up. It's going to take time, but I'm confident that eventually enough scientists are going to listen and realize what I'm saying to admit, well, maybe we were wrong.
Well, and it takes a big person to admit that, but you know what? They have to fess up every once in a while, don't they?
Well, my prediction on this is not that the scientific consensus on global warming is ever going to officially change. What I think is most likely to happen is the issue will slowly die away. We will just hear less and less about it in the coming years, and eventually, you know, everyone's going to say, hey, whatever happened to global warming?
Yeah. Well, is that because there will be other issues on this planet that will be more important or more, I guess, dangerous for all of us?
Yeah, maybe? That'll be part of it. You know, there's a news cycle. It's like, you know, we get all of these news stories for a while that, oh, no, we're all going to die from global warming. And then we get kind of bored with that story, and then we move on to something else.
Well, if there's a third world war, we're not going to be talking about global warming.
Well, that's definitely true. If something major happens, then, yeah, then man-made global warming will really be put on the back burner.
And it was interesting that when they talked about the swine flu pandemic, which we said never would occur, that seemed to push a lot of stuff to the background, too.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, that's part of the alarmist media is, you know, they try to blow up anything that happens and make it into a bigger news story than it really is.
True.
Which sells because, hey, we want to be entertained. You know, the public wants to be entertained. And for some reason, we're really fascinated with the possibility of any kind of huge disaster, Armageddon, whatever, you know. We like to think in those science fiction-y terms.
In my 41 years of broadcasting, I have never seen or heard a newscast begin by saying, it's a nice day today.
Somebody that's always been in a family had a family that's always been in the newspaper business, he said that they always used to say, bad news is good news.
Well, in the old television business, they used to say, if it bleeds, it leads. You know? Let's go to Atoka, Oklahoma, east of the Rockies. Carl, go ahead with your question, Carl.
Hello, George and Roy.
Hi.
I have a comment to make first, if I may.
Sure, absolutely.
The sudden freezing of our Earth and the extinction of the woolly mammoths was caused by a total collapse of our Earth's gravity and internal heat generation. It happened within a matter of a few minutes, and the animals were literally frozen rock solid in their tracks.
Now, what caused that collapse, Carl?
The collapse was caused by a desynchronization of the moon's orbital gravity grasp upon our Earth's off-center core. As soon as that core pulls out of the moon's gravity, the core starts to spin with the Earth's rotation on its axis. That unbalanced the Earth, and it started to wobble. The gravity immediately collapsed. The atmosphere immediately expanded and flash froze the whole Earth.
Now, what got it back to normal again?
It takes 35 million years when this major cycle comes. We have two different cycles that converge coming up in 2012, by the way. It takes 35 million years for the rotating core inside the Earth to dissipate and spread out. The moon, in the meantime, moves to a larger, slower period of orbit due to the collapse of the Earth's gravity. And then the moon picks up a seed of a new core, and as that builds back up and the gravity field strength comes back up and the internal heat restarts, then the Earth's expanded crust, which it did expand as soon as it quit rotating around its core because it increased its centrifugal velocity around the Earth. And the expansion of the atmosphere let the tectonic plates come open and we had massive volcanism.
How do you know this, by the way, Carl?
I have been studying this for 22 years.
That's fascinating.
Now
let's get your question, then we'll get Roy's feedback on this. Go ahead.
Okay, I have a dinosaur and other fossil skin, bone, and flesh samples here in Atoka that I have collected because I know where to look for them. And I read the layers of Mother Earth. That's how I'm able to find these things.
All right. And do you have a question for Roy?
If you have a phone number somewhere where I can reach you during the daytime, or can I leave my number and ask you to call me?
Well, do you have a computer at all?
No, Carl? I do not. I only have a shortwave radio and an AM/FM radio and a telephone. I don't have a TV.
I'll tell you what. We'll put you on hold, and you can give Tom your phone number, and he'll get it to Roy. And if Roy has time to call you, he will. So we'll do it like that. So, Tommy, get his number. What do you think of his statement, though, about the moon, the gravitational pull, the total collapse? What do you think?
Well, I'd say it's highly speculative. maybe it's the next theme for Al Gore's next movie.
You never know. Okay, Carl, just stay on hold. Tommy will get you in a second. Let's go to Eugene, Oregon. Justin on the wild card line. Hi, Justin. Go ahead.
Hey, Roy, I just wanted to compliment you on your efforts and your research there. I think it's great that you're trying to kind of put some truth to the matter and kind of call out what actually might be happening, which might be more related to the sun and just the natural cycles of our universe here. But I did kind of want to call in point something. You know, you kind of said that there's some economic impact to all this rush to all this, green and, concern for the environment and how big of a thing it would be. In fact, you said it would be crippling to the economy. People will die. Well, what's going on with oil and coal and what could happen with a major nuclear disaster? And, in fact, what just happened with a bunch of people there in West Virginia? How about those people off those oil rigs? How about the thousands of people that die every year in China for coal? You extrapolate quite a bit, and you say you like to be on the side of truth. Well, why do you have to extrapolate, get people so worked up in a state of fear? And, you seem to have the impression that everything's just fine the way it is, or that, we need to just move so incrementally slow towards something that, you deem to be appropriate. Why can't we just make these changes? I mean, for God's sakes, we went to the moon and we spend trillions of dollars for war. How about these banksters that just, tanked our economy yet again? And, you can't blame it on Obama. You can't blame it on Bush. In fact, Bush did more good for solar and renewable energy than Obama has. So I'm definitely not partisan here. I'm just trying to point out, you should be very cautious about what you're claiming.
Well, I understand your concern, but I like to think I know something about basic economics. Yes, what you're saying is true, that coal mining is very hazardous and people get killed every year. If personally, I would prefer that, we have mostly nuclear power electricity rather than coal power because it's a lot safer, I believe, all things considered. But this country uses 1,000 gigawatts of electricity on a continuous basis. That's like 1,000 1-gigawatt nuclear power plants. Now, let's say we want to build, let's switch 500 of our coal-fired into nuclear. How long do you think it's going to take to build 500 new nuclear power plants? It's going to take a long time. Like I said earlier, if there was a large-scale replacement for fossil fuels, yeah, let's go do it. I'm all for alternative forms of energy. What I'm against is the government forcing us into some forms that are so much more expensive that it ends up causing the poor people that used to live on the edge of poverty to end up, being destitute and a lot of them dying for a lack of, let's say, refrigeration. I mean, a lot of people in the world die because they don't have the refrigeration needed to prevent foodborne illnesses. What happens when they can't afford that anymore, a refrigerator or electricity? So there is no such thing as a no-risk activity in human affairs.
Well, in 2005, Roy, 42,636 people died in traffic accidents in 2005. With those kinds of figures, you would think we're going to ban driving.
That's right. And, of course, it's a cost versus benefit issue. You know, we every time we make a decision, even to take a bite of food, we're weighing risks against benefits. Some people die of choking on food. Does that mean we stop eating? There are no zero-risk human activities, and that's true of our energy sources as well.
Absolutely. Will you stay with us? Dr. Roy Spencer, our special guest tonight, author of The Great Global Warming Blunder. We'll come right back in just a moment and take your phone calls. By the way, Skype is up and running for you right now. Just dial in at George 97313. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Roy Spencer, our special guest, and your final phone calls. Quick night here. Roy, very quickly, review again your major theory of the great global warming blunder, and what you talked about was climate feedback.
Okay, well, the place we have to start with that is with basic global warming theory. Most people don't realize that it's not the direct warming from the extra CO2 that we're putting in the atmosphere that is of concern for global warming, because everyone in this business agrees that the direct warming effect of more CO2 in the atmosphere is pretty small. It's the indirect effects, which are called feedbacks. For instance, how will clouds change with the warming? Now, the scientific consensus these days is that clouds will change in such a way to greatly amplify warming and cause man-made global warming to be anywhere from a moderate to a catastrophic problem.
Okay.
What the book is about is the fundamental mistake that these researchers have made coming to that conclusion about clouds. They have mixed up cause and effect when they've looked at how clouds vary with temperature. They have ignored causation in one direction. In the real climate system, there are cloud changes that cause temperature changes, and there are temperature changes that cause cloud changes. And one of those directions of causation has been totally ignored in climate research. So that's the blunder that the book is about, is the scientists that have made this mistake in cause versus effect in the climate system, and it completely changes the, you know, what global warming is going to end up being in terms of a forecast. You know, it, rather than Al Gore's Armageddon, it could well be that man-made global warming ends up being lost in the noise of natural climate variability. And I think what we're seeing in nature, for instance, the warming we've seen in the last 30 years, is simply part of an internal natural cycle, which is due, again, to clouds, just natural changes in cloud cover of the Earth.
Okay, let's go back to the phones now. Santa Barbara, we go. Pasquale, take it away. Hi there.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call. I'm sure so thing. Happy you have an intelligent man on, the Dr. Roy. It's so refreshing. Well, my experience, I have a question. It'll just take about 30 seconds, but I want to tell it sequentially. I think you'll get a kick out of it, okay? It's not that long, but I listened to your shows, and there was a man on some months ago who said that there was a central sun in our galaxy that was contributing to the warming of the planet. And I thought about that, and he said all the planets are warming, not just the Earth, and I was thinking about that. So I called up. I was listening to Michio Kaku, and he says that it's so easy, the math is easy. Of course, there's human cause for global warming, and he says it's real simple. Measure the sunlight coming in and the radiation leaving, and there's a difference, and it's caused by man. So I called him and told him what I just said. Is there a central sun cause? And he just doesn't even say anything about that and just repeats what I just said. Then I called my uncle up, Edmund DiMarzio, who's a physicist. I said, Uncle Ed, this physicist was telling me I'm really an idiot because I don't agree with him. And my uncle said, you're right, though. They can't really measure radiation when it's leaving the planet. They say they can. And he said there's two reasons they can't figure out mathematically, is that the moist air rises and dry air comes down, and he says there's these columns all over the planet, and we cannot measure that. And he said until we can, we can't really prove global warming. So I wanted to share that with Dr. Roy, and I know it's a lot more complicated, but I think it's like a business. The big governments want to control the small developing governments. I think that's what's really happening with the emissions.
Well, there is a grain of truth in what you're saying. For instance, the whole idea of these columns of air that are rising and sinking, that's true. That's what the climate system is always doing. The global atmosphere is continuously overturning. When you've got a rainy day in your town, that's when the air where you are at happens to be rising. When you have a sunny day with not a cloud in the sky, that's an area where the air is sinking. And for all that sinking air, there has to be rising air. For all the rising air, there has to be sinking air. Now, how all this relates to global warming is that water vapor is the main greenhouse gas of the atmosphere, and it's precipitation systems that are formed by these rising and sinking air currents that cause the water vapor content of the atmosphere to be what it is. And we don't even understand what controls that precipitation process. In other words, what kinds of changes could happen with precipitation, which suddenly might lead to slightly less water vapor in the atmosphere, which could cause cooling. Because, like I said, water vapor is the main greenhouse gas. So, you know, your physicist uncle is correct in the sense that there are certain things that we don't understand. Something else that he touched on, which, you know, didn't get quite right, but it reminded me of this. The mechanism for man-made global warming is an imbalance, as the caller mentioned, between incoming sunlight and then the outgoing infrared radiation from the Earth. You know, supposedly, man-made global warming is being caused by the extra CO2 in the atmosphere reducing the Earth's ability to cool through infrared radiation to outer space. Now, what's fascinating about this mechanism is it cannot actually be measured. The very best satellite sensors we have up there right now cannot measure the small imbalance. It can only be computed theoretically. So the whole theory of man-made global warming is based on theoretical computations, not upon observation.
Let's go back to Eugene, Oregon again for Mike now on the wild card line. Hi, Mike.
Hey, George. Hey, Roy.
Hey, Mike.
I've been listening all night, and I just had a brief comment.
Sure.
First, I don't know, you know, about the carbon dioxide. I just listened to what you said, and it's hard to find clear information on it. But I do know that most movements that are coming out of the mainstream and the UN have ulterior motives. And Gore's film was definitely a political piece. There may be a grain of truth in that. But I strongly disagree that the Earth is not acting in a cause and effect manner to, you know, massive short-sighted industrialization and development. All the polycarbonate waste we put out, oil spills, coal waste, mercury, toxic emissions, carbon monoxide, nuclear waste, you know, tearing up the planet's forests, pumping petroleum and replacing it with water, turning rainforest into soybean and dumping in oceans, you know, most certainly is going to lead to some blowback. Do you really think we are good stewards and not on a slippery slope of destruction?
Well, now, see, that. But again, though, Michael, that's what we're talking about here. Nobody that I've talked to has been opposed to keeping the environment healthy. I mean, everybody I've talked to wants us to have a better environment, and that includes all the things you just talked about. But I don't see any of that contributing to climate change. Do you, Roy?
No. Climate change is basically, you know, the whole theory is based on the CO2 emissions from burning of fossil fuels. That's the fundamental basis. I mean, the caller makes a good point. We need to clean up our messes to the extent possible.
Well, every point he mentioned, I would agree with in terms of what we're doing to the planet. But, you know, that's not affecting the climate.
Right. George, can I mention something about a previous caller? Previous
sure.
caller that I sort of dismissed as a very speculative theory. He had this long, drawn-out theory of what could have caused the woolly mammoths in northern Siberia.
It had to do with the collapse of the gravity.
Collapse of the gravity field. Well, while I don't see any way for the gravity field to collapse, but I would like to learn more about that idea, as long as the Earth has mass, it has gravity, the element of what he was talking about that is correct is that is actually one way you could flash freeze, you know, animals at the surface of the Earth. is if you got rid of, instantaneously got rid of, like half the gravity of the Earth, the atmosphere would do exactly what the caller said. It would quickly expand upward, and that expansion would cause a reduction in pressure at the surface, which would cause instant cooling and could actually do this flash freezing thing.
Huh.
So there was an actual a grain of truth to what he was saying, but somehow you'd have to cause the gravitational field of the Earth to collapse. So, you know, somebody was thinking out of the box with that theory, but it was something I hadn't thought of before.
Yeah, that is an amazing theory indeed. We've got his phone number for you if you want to call him, Roy, at your own leisure, if you want to talk more about that.
Sure.
Redwood City, California. Robert, it's your turn. Go ahead, Robert.
Hi, George. Earlier tonight, you were asking Dr. Spencer about his motivations or who might be funding him. But I want to know who's behind a lot of this myth and fear of global warming. I just found out recently that a very unknown person by the name of Barack Obama, while serving on the Joyce Foundation from before 2002, helped fund the Chicago Climate Exchange. That's the premier greenhouse gas trading system that will be fully funded by us, the taxpayers, if the cap and trade goes through. The head of the CCX says that it'll be worth $10 trillion per year if the cap and trade goes through. And who owns the CCX? Who owns the CCX? 50% ownership is Goldman Sachs. Another 10% is owned by an outfit out of London, which includes Al Gore, David Blood, who's a Goldman Sachs ex-executive, and three or four other Goldman Sachs execs. And how did the CCX get the major funding when the Joyce Foundation money ran out in 2002? Well, from 2002 to 2010, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were the heaviest investors in the Chicago
No way.
Climate Exchange.
I got to look this up. It's out there?
I just sent you an email earlier tonight. It was on Glenn Beck's Beck Show tonight.
Okay. Very good.
This is one of those things where, you know, this really is going on. I mean, from everything that I've seen and heard, there is indeed a lot of people that are going to make a lot of money off of this carbon taxation. You can call it whatever you want, cap and trade. It ends up being an additional tax, and there's going to be people that get extremely wealthy off of it. And from what I know of a lot of what the caller just stated, it's true.
That's frightening. But you know what? Understandable. If there's money to be made, there's somebody's going to try to do it.
Yeah, well, I just wish people would realize that government-funded research is not necessarily objective research. I mean, I know the people who in the government who have been program managers, who have gone to Congress to ask for money. And, you know, this is not an unbiased field of scientific research. If the threat of man-made global warming goes away, you can no longer go back to Congress and ask for hundreds of millions of dollars to do man-made global warming research. Congress isn't going to give you the money.
Robert, I'll look for that email. Andrew in Orlando, Florida. There you go, Andrew. Go ahead.
It's an honor, George. I was thinking, well, a lot of people kind of forget. They always want to try and switch over to, alternative research or resources. Like you said, electric cars. A lot of people forget that, you know, that to make those electric cars, you got to make lead batteries. And in turn, when you got to dispose of them, and the lead is obviously toxic. So no matter what, you're causing, problems with the environment. You're probably the best way to go. Matter of fact, first Ford Model T ran on hemp fuel. I think it's probably one of the best ways to go with it because of the same amount of carbon dioxide the hemp takes out of the air. When you burn it off, it releases the exact same amount back into the air, so it balances out the environment with that. But my main question was, I know we said with the volcano, it obviously wouldn't cause a flash freeze, but with maybe like a super volcano, like the Yellowstone National Park volcano going off, wouldn't that cause something, detriment to the environment for more than, so like you say, in 1 to 2 years before it cleaned itself up?
Yeah, it probably would last longer. I'm not an expert in how long something like that can last, but yeah, you could conceive of a super volcanic event, something that has not been seen in human history but we know has happened in Earth's history. If something like that happened again, like the Yellowstone event, it could be that you would be in for maybe 10, 20 years of a complete collapse of the biosphere from the lack of sunlight. The caller makes a good point that it could be much worse. So let's just hope something like that doesn't happen.
Roy, it doesn't take much globally, temperature up or down 1 or 2 degrees, to make massive change, right?
Well, it depends on what you mean by massive change. Mother Nature makes massive change all the time. You know, every couple of years we have an El Niño or La Niña. Well, every time one of those natural climate events occurs, there are ecosystems around the world, mainly in the tropics, that are virtually decimated. You know, there are droughts over land. There are changes in populations of different kinds of animals in the Galapagos Islands. Mother Nature can be cruel. You know, it's not all roses. You know, there are cases where just natural changes cause huge effects on the biosphere, negative ones. Not everything that happens when Mother Nature changes is good.
Home of the Queen Mary, Long Beach, California. We go. John, take it away. Go ahead, John.
Hey, thank you. I'll try to be quick. This is a Democrat that voted for Gore in 2000. Listen, I think this guy's arrogant with his, you know, they won't entertain any notions like the inconvenient truth, like they know the truth. It really bothers me. I'm in the media myself, a journalist, and my journalist buddies, I sit and ask them, they all look down, a lot of them are liberals, you know. If you've had elections in newsrooms, you'd have very few Republicans elected. And, you know, I say, you guys look down your nose at every form of energy, coal, you know, I'm from West Virginia, so I know, coal, the nuclear power. They look down their noses at all of them, and even when you have wind turbines, they're worried about the birds getting chopped up in them. I'm not willing, unless I have a lot more proof than Al Gore's offering, to destroy our whole economic system, which is based on energy, by gutting coal, by gutting, you know, oil, you know, getting rid of all these things based on suppositions that haven't been proven yet. And this is what scares me, because once we go down that slope, it's going to be hard coming back the other way. And I think we're really toying with destroying our economic system. What do you think about that?
Well, as we talked a little bit earlier, Roy, this is an effort, I also believe, to bring the United States in par with some of the other nations. We got too big for our britches, and they want to bring us down.
Yeah, I think that's part of it, George. And I think the caller makes excellent points, and he said it more eloquently than I could have.
Yeah, he sure did. Roy, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being on the program, The Great Global Warming Blunder. You also have another bestseller already out there as well, Climate Confusion. What do you do next? In 20 seconds, what's up next for you?
Trying to convince the scientific community that they've made a blunder.
All right. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.